Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. Good to have you here. We're going to take a look at some of the things that have been talked about around the country and in this city, around the Confederate flag, the Confederate monuments, and more, and what they mean for our culture, what they mean for our communities, and what we should really be saying and doing about them, and what they really represent and why they're here. We're joined by Zoe Carpenter, the nation's assistant Washington editor. She wrote a blog post, A History of Hate Rock, from Johnny Rebel to Dylann Roof. A very interesting piece that we'll be linking to on our website. Good to have you back with us, Zoe.
Thanks for having me.
Chris Roberts is in the studio. He's an advocate and a doctoral student and instructor in the African American Studies Department at Temple University and joins us here. He's back for the summer. Good to have you with us, Chris.
Thank you, Mark, for having me.
Dr. Tara Bynum will be joining us shortly. And we're here with Yoni Applebaum. We have her set up? No, not yet. Okay. So Yoni is will be this in a moment. She's senior editor at The Atlantic, where he oversees the politics section and wrote the article, Why the Flag is Still There. And you all can join us here at 410-319-8888. Tweet us at Mark Steiner. Comment on our Facebook page. Send us an email to talk@steinershow.org. But do call 410-319-8888. So let me start with you. And it's good to have you with us again, once again.
Thank you.
So, you know, it was interesting to read this. I don't listen to the music a lot.
Nor did I.
I'm not surprised to hear that. But you did for this, I suppose, right?
Sorry, I didn't catch that.
So let's talk about what some people are saying. Of course, that Dylann Roof was moved to do what he did because of taking part in listening to this racist punk rock music. I may be putting too much on the music itself, but talk a bit about what you pulled out of that.
Sure. So his cousin told a reporter for The Intercept that he was, quote, normal until he started listening to that white power music.
Right.
Stuff. So I was just curious what that white power music stuff is. And as I found, there's actually quite a history of punk rock and black metal and other types of music being used by white supremacist groups to channel their ideology, particularly to young people. And people who study these groups and former members of skinhead groups say that this is actually one of the most, if not the most effective tool that groups have to reach out to young people for the recruiting. So we don't have a lot of information right now about what Dylann may have been listening to specifically, but it wouldn't be surprising if that was one of the channels through which his racism crystallized.
Now, I think, Yoni Applebaum, are you with us?
Pleased to join you.
Oh, good to have you with us. Yoni Applebaum, as I said, is senior editor at The Atlantic, where he oversees the politics section and wrote the article entitled, Why is the Flag Still There? And he and Ta-Nehisi Coates' piece, Take Down the Confederate Flag Now, were two companion pieces, I think, that said a great deal about all this, and we'll be jumping into that. But, I think that part of this is that the culture of racism is deep in America, and it plays itself out and plays itself out in a number of ways. Yoni, and you were kind of covering that in many ways in Take Down the Confederate Flag. I mean, in your piece on the Confederate flag, why is it still here?
Well, that's right. This is a symbol that was originally created in the defense of slavery, but then passed into relative obscurity for the next century before being revived in opposition to desegregation. So these symbols that resonate culturally and can be attached with a variety of meanings are rooted in specific historical moments. Like a lot of other symbols of the Confederacy, the flag was taken up and revived at a moment when racial progress seemed possible and used by opponents of desegregation as a rallying point in their efforts to block that progress.
So, I mean, I wonder how we all think that fuels the spirit, how the music, how the flag, how the sense of identity fuels the passion of the movement of resistance to black freedom, the resistance to a new America, to what people think as the white cause, which is being raised once again, Chris?
Thank you. One thing on that note I would say is that we have to also look at the way that images are used, because we've already talked about in this conversation already, we talked about music. We've talked about different things. But I also want us to think about a poignant moment. This is actually 100 years out from the release of The Birth of a Nation as a film. And we find ourselves 1915 to 2015. Where are we? And one thing I would like to say is that in addition to the flag or the music, film has been a very important cultivator of this sort of white supremacist investment and the creation of this over generations. Because I think one of the questions people have that I've heard is Mr. Roof was 21. And people in some circles seem to think that white supremacy is a thing of the past. But I think that we see that this is a very relevant, very contemporary issue of now. And the thing that I would like us to come to the table is that 100 years ago, as now, media was one of the primary ways in which these messages were perpetrated throughout society and validated in many instances by the state and by society.
So, I mean, Zoe, I really do want to leap into this for a minute, just this broader question. I mean, and your article kind of, and the article that Yoni wrote as well, and other pieces coming out, that maybe start kind of wrestling with this idea of the power of culture, how it does shape and mold, how it speaks to people's hearts and minds. And also this, how in our country, in these 600 years of race and racism being center in the Western world, that culture is what fuels how people feel and think.
I think that's very true, and it's really interesting to look at how the explicit racism in culture changes what's considered explicit, but how some of the underlying threads remain the same. So with the music, we have this thing that we call hate rock, and we think of it as being very separate from other popular forms of music and mainstream forms of music, but there are actually lots of linkages. A neo-Nazi band called Screwdriver was once very influential in mainstream punk circles, and so I think it's very important as we talk about these cultural symbols like the Confederate flag or music that we consider where the overlaps are with other forms of cultural expression that we don't consider to be racist, because I think the continuum is actually part of a continuum rather than just separate parts of culture.
Because I think we try to separate sometimes politics and culture, and I mean, well, go to Yoni and then jump over to the other guests and Chris. And so, but we can't. I mean, you're the politics editor here for the Atlantic, but you can't separate the two. And the flag is fueled by a cultural understanding that is political as well.
That's exactly right. Politics doesn't start and stop on Election Day. There's a broader cultural politics that we're constantly engaged in making and in remaking. And when you take something like the pervasive romanticization of the antebellum South, the Lost Cause mythology that attaches to the Confederacy, that has many expressions. And I think thinking of it as a continuum is just about exactly right. Some people are clearly using the Confederate flag as an explicitly racist symbol. For others, it means they've invested it, imbued it with other meanings that are more personal to them. They may not even be fully aware or cognizant of the associations that it will call up in others. For them, it may be a symbol of personal rebellion, a symbol of Southern culture. But they can't dismiss those other layered meanings either. And in the development of white supremacist subcultures at the fringe, often what you see is taking a symbol with some greater degree of mainstream acceptability and stripping away those more mainstream connotations. And I think that's true of hate rock. I think it's true of the flag and other relics of the Confederacy. There's a broader cultural contest that's being waged over these sorts of symbols and seeing it not just as entertainment but as the very stuff of politics, I think, is crucially important.
If I may also do want to maybe here, I think a historical context would be important if we, because my point is that when you talk about just not divorcing politics and culture, I think we have to ask the question of the idea of the, quote, American has been constantly redefined. And the Civil War was one of the redefining moments of what it meant to be a, quote, American. And after that, you had the, quote, Reconstruction, which a lot of this effort was to rebuild and reconnect this fallen Union. And part of that was to make the South feel a part of the whole again, to make the South feel comfortable, to not make the South feel separated. And you have to, in certain ways politically, make certain things acceptable from that society. One of those things that you saw in the late 1800s was you did see the emergence of a lot of Confederate monuments and Confederate cemeteries and Confederate statues throughout not just Maryland, but a lot of states in the South, and I'm sure we'll get to this more later. But what I think is important for us to understand is that part of what it means to now be an American was redefined then in 1865, and part of that redefinition was to make white supremacist society feel a part of the collective whole. And I think the question we're grappling with today is, what does that mean when you have had a society that has tried to join separate sides, but it's one side with a very particular view of a particular part of the population, if that's clear.
Well, I mean, so whether you're taking the what you were just describing, Chris, and whether you're taking this kind of passion for this flag, this Confederate flag, mm-hmm. and I'm predicting here that you're going to see a lot more Confederate flags waving around the country, and where we live in particular here in Baltimore, D.C., Virginia, and southern Pennsylvania, you're going to see flags all over the place mm-hmm. because they're already omnipresent, but they're really, you're going to see them. They're just going to become part of the landscape. What that represents, and what you were talking about in your article, Zoe, with the music, with punk rock and the kind of racist music that kind of impassions the far fringes of this movement, but also seeps into the broader culture as well. But we're talking about a period now where we've had maybe 50 years of a countercultural movement trying to build a new sense of what it means to be American that is really going up against what is deeply ingrained culturally the exact opposite way.
Yeah, and I think we do see that struggle with to define some sort of identity playing out in the music scene. And you know, what was interesting to me is that I think for some of the kids, including a former skinhead that I spoke with, he perceived the message that he was getting through the white power music as being a positive one, about being, about building up community, about defending your family, and this idea of defending some idea of America, which is obviously white America. And I think that, you know, when people, if we're going to see an explosion of Confederate flags, this idea of defending some notion of identity, I think that's what's going on. And that plays out in other types of political discourse. The way that we talk, or the way that the right wing talks about immigration, for example, is all about defending America. And that's a pretty explicit example of how something that, on the one hand, is fringe, if you look at it in white power music, is actually in the mainstream in the political discourse in other ways.
What do you mean by that?
Well, so, you know, when you hear a lot of politicians, you know, Steve King, for example, talk about immigration, it's about these others invading the country. So it's this idea that we need to preserve America from intrusion. That's essentially the same thing that white supremacists are saying. They need to preserve their culture from some kind of intrusion from the racialized other. It's fundamentally the same argument.
Yoni?
Well, that's a really interesting perspective, and certainly there are echoes of these arguments. But one of the fascinating things about this particular moment is that we're seeing two things unfold simultaneously, and they're driving each other. One is a much broader cultural turn away from this sort of things. I just saw that the governor of Alabama has just ordered the flag taken down on the grounds of the state capitol there. That would have been unimaginable a week ago. It's coming down at the Citadel. We saw the entire political leadership, the Republican political leadership of the state of South Carolina, stand together in unity and call for the flag to come down. It's been removed from the shelves of most major retailers. That is an astonishing shift. And often at moments of cultural change, that is precisely when we see those elements on the fringe become more vehement, feel more embattled and besieged, and lash out. And so it's precisely at moments of progress and change, when things are very much in flux, that we tend to see the greatest risk and threat from extremists who may feel particularly beset by the broader culture, at moments where they feel as if their concerns are being addressed by political leaders, they're less likely to lash out violently, at moments like the one that we are astonishingly finding ourselves in right now. I think it's much more common to find extremist groups moving toward even more extreme rhetoric, toward even more extreme actions. And it's tough to sort of see that unfolding simultaneously, because it can feel, if you're watching Confederate flags come out, if you're watching people speak out in opposition to the shift, it feels as if we're moving backwards. But in fact, that backlash is coming because of the forward progress.
If I may take just a quick comment on the question of, and I think that we, and as we continue to have these conversations and build out these discussions, I think we would want to constantly be vigilant in this question of progress and what is improvement, because I think that we we must also understand we are in a moment where 9 people were massacred and killed by this person, and we are having this conversation at the expense of these lives and at the expense of these moments, in addition to all the other atrocities that we have seen. And when we look back at the sort of historical record or historical moment of this country, at least for me as a scholar, I think we have to seriously look at what's happened. And we have 300 years of evidence that gives us 300 plus years of evidence that gives us a very not too encouraging idea of what this country does with the lessons of the past. Because what I would say we've seen a lot more in history is we have seen more of a political convenience around these things. We very rarely see any movements where there's a proactive nature in this country, because I think for a lot of people of African descent or African Americans, yeah, we may see the flags or people may see these flags coming down, but it is known that if the symbol leaves, but if the actions remain, or if the political, what's policy? I think that's the question that people want to ask as well. So in South Carolina, in Alabama, is there going to be policy concurrent with the rhetoric? And I think that is something that people will want to watch for, because if it's merely a political move to sort of acquiesce and subdue the masses for the moment, that's one thing. But are we going to see substantive policy change around the issues that are putting black bodies in harm every day?
So before we take a break here and go to the phones at 410-319-8888 and before Zoe has to leave, so let me just throw something out at you. In your covering of this, of all that goes on around us, there's something, I've been bringing this up a lot during the last months. There's something historically afoot in America that we're in the middle of, and maybe when you're a much older person, you and you Zoe and Chris will kind of be looking back at this era 30 years from now, discussing what this meant. But in some ways, we're at the cusp of something, it seems to me, whether it's what we're looking in this debate around the Confederate flag because of the tragic massacre of 9 people at the historic Mother Emanuel Church in Charleston, or the coming to light because of video of police brutality and killing of people of color in this country, and people now becoming aware of how race and racism defines America in ways we've not really discussed in the kind of depth that's being begun discussed in America. So I wonder where you think we are.
Well, I think we are certainly at a very important moment. But as Chris just said, I think it remains to be seen whether the moment continues to unfold and be used as an opportunity for actual real policy change. I think it's great and courageous in some ways that, in many ways, that Nikki Haley supported taking the Confederate flag down. Now, can we get her to support the Medicaid expansion?
Right. I'm not laughing at it, but with you, yes.
Yeah,
right,
if we really want to materially improve the lives of people, let's get health care. Let's pass the new Voting Rights Act. Like, there are things on the table that have direct connections to the safety and well-being of black folks. So let's pass those things. Let's build on this momentum from the Black Lives Matter movement and all of that. I think what is amazing right now is we do have sort of the new seeds for civil disobedience and for actual demonstrations happening, and I think that's absolutely necessary for any further political and policy progress.
Zoe Carpenter, it's always great to have you with us, national and the nation's assistant Washington editor, and her blog post, A History of Hate Rock from Johnny Rebel to Dylan Roof, is really, really well done, and people should read it. We'll be connecting to it on our website, and I appreciate you being with us, Zoe, as always.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
Always. And we're going to take a very short break. Yoni stays with us, as does Chris Roberts. Tara Bynum should be coming in the studio soon. We'll be joined by Evan Serpik as we continue our conversation. We'll open the phones at 410-319-8888. Alan's the first caller up, and we have an email here from Peter on the Confederate flag, which I'll be reading as well. All that coming up. And as we go to break, we're hearing She's Not There, The Zombies. Colin Blundstone of The Zombies, born this day in 1945. We'll be right back. How would I know? Why should I care? Please don't bother trying to find her. Man comes on the radio. He's telling me more and more about some useless information. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. And that's Devo drummer Alan Myers, passed away on this day in 2013 as one of our musical minutes here on the Mark Steiner Show. And we continue our conversation about the Confederate flag, about the symbol, about culture, about these monuments in this city. We are joined here in studio by Chris Roberts, a doctoral student and instructor in African American Studies at Temple University, and an advocate. We are now joined by Dr. Tara Bynum, assistant professor of English at Towson University. Yoni Applebaum is remaining with us as well, senior editor at The Atlantic, where he oversees politics, the politics section, who wrote an article, Why Is the Flag Still There? And we are linking to that article on our website at steinershow.org, along with Ta-Nehisi Coates' piece, Take Down the Confederate Flag Now. And you all can join us here at 410-319-8888. Oh, and Evan Serpik is with us. I'm sorry, Evan, who, of course, is the editor-in-chief of the Baltimore City Paper, who is beginning a campaign here in Baltimore, wrote the article Stop Honoring White Supremacy and started an online petition to change the name of Robert E. Lee Park. So 410-319-8888. We'll get to the calls coming in here. Write to us here at talk@steinershow.org. And let me just read this quick email, and we'll go for a comment to Yoni before we open the phones here and introduce Evan Serpik to talk about his campaign around the Baltimore issues and how they affect national issues and beyond. But Peter Carlos wrote in, the NRA has got us going again. Yes, the Confederate flag has questionable symbolism. Yes, a true fact in that respect, but the NRA is overjoyed now because the Confederate flag is now employed, either by design or coincidence, as a great decoy for them to rest behind, so to speak, to avoid the talk about gun control on any level. What geniuses, says Peter Carlos. What do you think about that, Yoni?
Well, I don't think that we have to see these things as mutually exclusive.
Right.
Certainly, this is a moment where we could be pressing for additional policy change. I suspect people will take advantage of this moment to press for meaningful, substantive policy changes. But let's not underestimate the power of symbolism or the drama of what we're watching unfold. For every young girl who's walking in the door of a Jefferson Davis elementary school this morning, for every young boy who's going to visit their state legislator and a week ago have walked past the flag of the army that fought to keep their great-grandparents in bondage and today won't, those are real changes. They shape lives in deep and profound ways. And as we watch these symbols come down, as we watch this shift take place, yes, it may be being done by politicians just because they're bending to the will of the moment. But that's okay. That's how a democracy works. We've had 400 years of racial violence in this country. We had another terrible and tragic incident of racial violence. The fact that this time the flags are coming down, that means something. It doesn't mean everything. It's not going to fundamentally change America. But it does represent a significant shift and one that we should take stock of, measure, and appreciate.
And I just add, and I want to introduce our other guests here, and Tara Bynum's in studio. Good to see you, Tara, once again. Glad you're here. And we'll kind of come to Evan Serpik. That it was interesting to me that, you know, when I watched this flag, and it makes me think of the monuments here in Baltimore and around the country, and a Robert E. Lee Park that exists everywhere that honor these Confederate soldiers and leaders of the Confederacy, what that says and what kind of debate that should stir up in us in a conversation. And as I was hearing you talk, as you were speaking, Yoni, and that flag is down, yet where the flag was standing, and another flag is still there, I think, that's on the ground, by the statue of Benjamin Tillman, who was former governor and former state senator and of South Carolina and a leader of the Confederacy and a Reconstruction era governor who said this after the Civil War. We disenfranchised as many as we could. We of the South have never recognized the right of the Negro to govern white men, and we never will. He said this on the floor of the U.S. Senate. We have never believed him to be the equal of the white man, and we will not submit to his gratifying his lust on our wives and our daughters without lynching him. And his statue stands outside the South Carolina halls of government. Mm-hmm. And so the flag is down, but little pitchfork Tillman is still hanging out. Tara?
I guess, you know, when this news of this kind of broke and this move to kind of want to remove symbols of the Confederacy happened, I admit I was a bit torn. Like, on the one hand, I in no way support the Confederacy. I mean, they're a treasonous government. And they wanted to support slavery. But at the same time, I am one that is left wondering to what end, you know? So if our investment is in removing these symbols, I guess I'm just left wondering about the students in my classroom who don't even know to look at the monuments at all, and yet they still know the rhetoric. So they aren't necessarily connecting the symbols themselves, the monuments, the fact that, you know, if, depending on how old you are, if you wanted to smoke cigarettes, you went to Robert E. Lee Park in Baltimore to do so. I guess what I'm wrestling with is ensuring that there is a clear connection between seeing the monuments and the young people who find their way into my classroom still having a very deep kind of connection to that discourse and yet don't know anything about the Confederacy.
So let me turn to Evan Serbeck. Evan is editor-in-chief of the City Paper here. Evan, we're good to have you with us.
Hi.
So talk a bit about this petition drive and the article you put on to change the name of Robert E. Lee Park here, because it fits in both the local and national discourse.
Right. Well, it's interesting to hear what Tara was saying, because I was partially motivated thinking about this because of my kids, and we live close to Robert E. Lee Park. We live in Mount Washington. And you know, they go to Mount Washington School, which is, you know, two-thirds or three-quarters African-American, and they have a lot of activities there in the park. And it always just seemed very strange that these kids were going to this park named after a man who led an army that fought to enslave their ancestors. And what kind of message does that send to these kids, that this is who we're honoring, this is sort of who we're choosing to look up to and talk about as a leader and as someone who we revere? And on Friday, partially inspired by Ta-Nehisi Coates's, Baltimore's own Ta-Nehisi Coates's article in The Atlantic that you referenced, and also by John Stewart, who talked about the roads in South Carolina that are named after Confederate generals that black people drive on every day and have to sort of be reminded of this legacy that the state is still proclaiming that it's proud of. It's proud of this legacy of upholding slavery. And so that led me last Friday to sort of write this petition and this editorial saying that we should really think about these things. And I referenced your producer, Stephanie Mavronis, did a great piece in January,
right,
talking about all the Confederate monuments in the city. And I learned a lot by reading about those. I didn't know a lot of those details. And it's a good question. What do we do with them? I mean, like I said in my piece, you know, the statues are a tough question because they are part of their history and there is teachable moments from them. To me, the park is a no-brainer. That shouldn't have happened to begin with. This is not a position of honor. It's something that, you know, we should think about who we really revere. The statues, I think there's a place for them in a museum. I think it's a place that we can visit and say, look, this is the kind of people we used to revere, and it's part of our history. It's part of our daily life. But I'm glad to hear that there's movement now with changing the park name. The governor and the mayor have both sort of signaled support for the change, and so hopefully that will happen.
I mean, I let me open the phones here and get some listeners in to talk with us as well. 410-319-8888. I don't disagree. I think that in some ways it would be great to have all those statues removed. With most of the statues here honoring the Civil War, except for one, are honoring Confederate soldiers,
right,
and generals. They should be moved to a museum, or maybe a Civil War museum that we can in Maryland, where in Baltimore, where there's one, so people can see these monuments, other things, discuss them about what they mean. You know, I'm not like ISIS. I don't want to tear down monuments and blow them up, but we can move them into places where they might belong rather than be part of the public sphere.
With this conversation, I think like we want to be able to tell these stories, but I think that there's so much unlearning historically that has to be done, and one of the things that I think that, again, we should watch for in some of the conversations around this is that we don't go into a false dichotomy of North as good and South as bad as far as the Civil War was concerned. And there's a quick Frederick Douglass excerpt I think he had in 1865 in Boston. Frederick Douglass stated that the Civil War was fought on the interest of slavery on both sides. The South was fighting to take slavery out of the Union, and the North fighting to keep it in the Union. The South fighting to get it beyond the limits of the United States Constitution, and the North fighting for the old guarantees. Both despising the Negro, both insulting the Negro. So I think that indeed, where we do need to tell these difficult, complicated, troubled histories, we need to make sure that the same voices that were silenced before are not then again silenced by another false regurgitation of history. So when we say we want to have these difficult historical conversations in public places, be they museums, classrooms, wherever, we really need to dig into the fact that there was no, as far as Du Bois and other scholars, this is an excerpt from Black Reconstruction by W.B. Du Bois, but a lot of the scholars of African descent have looked back at this moment and said there is no clear-cut good person as far as it was concerned for the outcome of the enslaved African person. And that is one thing. I would love to have that conversation historically, because I think we could learn a lot to be better people moving forward.
And I guess that's what kind of troubles me about the debate about the flag and the Confederate flag and the Confederate monuments, because I think from my vantage, they aren't necessarily history.
Well, they are and they aren't. I mean, but it's the Confederate states are gone.
Yeah, they're gone, and I get that. But in some ways, I think that the racism that they represent is not. And I think that,
right.
I guess what I'm saying is that I don't want us, and maybe this is what you were pointing to, like I don't want us to think that, oh, because the Confederate monuments have been put in a museum, that somehow we have righted our history. And I think that becomes very easy.
I just have to get to the phones here, but I think that's an important piece of discussion to have. But I think what Yoni, what you were saying a moment ago, is that each one of these steps is a step towards something new.
Yeah. It is. You know, if you go to the Maryland State House today, you'll find still the statue of Roger B. Taney.
Right.
The virulently racist Supreme Court justice. It was not torn down, but we erected a larger statue of Thurgood Marshall to show the complicated history of this state and the way it has evolved through time, without erasing the mistakes of the past, pointing toward more inspirational examples for the future. There is no national park in the United States, no national monument or memorial devoted to Reconstruction. The place that's been advanced for that repeatedly would be Beaufort, South Carolina. It was shot down in 2003 by the Sons of Confederate Veterans on the grounds that Reconstruction was not something worth honoring. There are a host of opportunities in Baltimore, in Maryland, and throughout the country for adding to our historical narrative the things that were erased out of it. So this is not simply about taking down the Confederate flag. I think the debate is shifting now, and we're starting to discuss other ways to expand the conversation, to add complexity to our historical memory, and to write back in the things that were erased out of it during the long intervening years.
I'm going to open the phones here. I have promised people dying to get in this conversation at 410-319-8888, and I think we are maybe at the historical cusp of beginning to wrestle the Reconstruction as it fits into the world today. And that's we started that on the show the other day in the conversations, and we need to push that idea, I think, just to be able to really understand that history in ways that we don't, because it's been seen in very negative light. 410-319-8888. Alan, you're on the air.
Everybody today.
Hi, Alan.
Hello?
Hi, Alan.
How are you doing? You know, I remember growing up, and my sister was a big fan of Gone with the Wind and hearing the band play The Night They Drove Old Dixie Down. And now it seems to be culminating more and more. And it's not just about taking down the flags, but we need to put another culture that opposes this kind of thing. If you don't like the Confederate flag, then it's our duty to present a viable alternative. There are peace flags out there. There are earth flags out there. There are green flags out there. There are red, black, and green flags out there. There are blue flags out there. There are red flags out there. But we need to start in our own diversity and unity, raising up these symbols and raising up and building our own statues. Somebody made a statue to Edward Stoughton and put it clandestinely there. Somebody needs to make a statue of Malcolm X and put it somewhere. We can't wait for the powers that be to grant us the right to raise our voices creatively, artistically, and humanly, and put our symbols out there. We need to hang little posters of Billie Holiday's Strange Fruit from every tree we can see so that people can hear that song and read those lyrics. We need to popularize in our way, wherever we can, the positive culture of positive change. And have a nice day.
Thank you, Alan. Let's go to another call here, 410-319-8888. Get a couple calls in a row so we can come back to our panelists. Let's go to Ricky on line three. You're on the air.
This is Ricky.
Good morning.
Point well taken. He wants to build from there. I say, okay, what I said the other day. We're all cousins in this country, whether we know it or not. When you put race into its scientific categories. Black and white, they are political terms in America. If you're black, you're for some sort of Afrocentric thing. If you're white, you're... But really, we're Europeans and Africans. Lastly, white supremacy, the concept of white supremacy is too hard for any human being to live up to, and they wind up hurting from it more than we do. Now, let me hit on the flag real quick. Robert E. Lee is a symbol of Robert E. Lee's battle cry. The real Confederate flag doesn't look anything like it, and it shouldn't be flying over a state building. They should be in a museum. One last thing. Reconstruction. I heard someone say this is part three of Reconstruction. The civil rights movement of the 60s was part two, and the efforts that were made in the beginning, however humble, were part one. Okay, I'm done.
Thank you, Ricky. And one more call. We'll come right back to the panel. 410-319-8888. Maggie, you're on the air. Line 5.
Thank you, Mark. Peace and blessings to all of you. I was thinking about the Confederate ways that things are weaved, hidden, and you don't even know that they're there. So I think we need to pay more attention to the presence of the Confederacy in places you go to, you know? And then I'll add to that, when President Abraham Lincoln said, you can fool some of the people all of the time, blank, 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 but none of the people all the time. And I think it would be important to read his response to the Dred Scott case. That is very interesting, very surprising. And it also allows Abraham Lincoln the truth of who he was as one who respected the law and those who used the law to go against people because of their color when they had their humanity above their color. So I think also Benjamin Franklin has a conversation on slavery that would open your eyes as well. So I'm going to go with this last statement. If we would understand that goodwill is the obligation of every living soul, every human being, then we would have a humanity. Thank you.
Thank you. Good to hear from you, Maggie. Thanks so much for calling in. 410-319-8888. Let me start with our phone guests to get some response to what they've heard and where they think this conversation may be taking America. Evan, and then we'll go over to Yoni and then come back to the studio here. Evan?
I think this is – I'm really enjoying hearing this discussion and the callers. I think a lot of people have really thoughtful things to say. And one of the things that I think is I'm hearing a lot is, why haven't we had this conversation before? And it's a good question. I know it's something that when I grew up in Baltimore but didn't really think about a lot of these things, didn't think about Robert E. Lee Park. It was just what it was called. It was only sort of once I moved back and had kids and went there and started thinking about, well, what, you know, again, what are these messages? I mean, what is the – I heard someone, Tiki Barber actually, was on the radio this morning talking about growing up and singing Dixie in school and not really listening to the words, but just sort of in his school singing, you know, an anthem about the South. And it wasn't until years later that he thought back and said, wait a second, we were, you know, revering this time period. He grew up in Southwest Virginia that really was all about enslaving my ancestors. And if we can have this discussion now, it's very late in the day, but it is just a giant step forward. And I think it's part of this fabric of white supremacy that I think we need to unweave and replace with something else.
Yoni?
I think that's exactly right. This is not the end of a process, but it's the beginning of a process. There are so many legacies of the Confederacy, of white supremacy, woven into the physical landscapes of our communities. And I think that this is a moment which has raised awareness of those legacies. People are paying attention to the names of their public institutions, the names of their parks, the names of their highways. And as those conversations start, I think they can be useful and productive conversations. They obviously are not going to lead us to the answers to all of the challenges that we are facing. But I think that the fact that these things have persisted in the landscape for so long ought to signal to us and been defended so vehemently should signal to us the fact that symbols really do matter. People would not be fighting, would not have fought so hard to keep the Confederate flag fluttering by the South Carolina Capitol if they weren't aware of the power of that symbol. And so we shouldn't downplay this moment of possibility to shift some of the symbols and to send a different message to future generations about what we value as a society.
If I can add one more thing, I was really related to that. I mean, I was really surprised when we posted this petition. We sort of thought, well, this is a no-brainer. You know, Robert E. Lee Park is just sort of an anachronism. It's something that everybody can kind of get behind. But I have to say, when we, you know, a giant discussion erupted on our Facebook page on the post itself, and probably the majority of people were dumbfounded. What are you talking about? What's the problem? It's part of history. It's part of our, you know, and we were, I have to say, very surprised with the vehemence that people not only opposed it, but really couldn't understand where this question was coming from. Kind of like, it's just so deeply embedded in so many people's lives that it's just never occurred to them that this was a problem. And I think you've seen that started to change this week. I think people have heard so many voices, so many people talk about their personal experiences. And I do think it's part of white privilege. I think when you live in an echo chamber of sort of, I don't have a problem with this. Why would anybody else have a problem with this? There must not be a problem with this. It must be their problem. But as more people come out and talk about their own experiences, their non-white people's experiences or white people's experiences, people start to realize, oh, this is something bigger. This is not just about the way I grew up, but this is about other people's lives and about other people's experiences. And I have definitely seen, as we posted about this over the last week or so, opinions changing. Which at the beginning of the week, it was really depressing to see the response. So I'd like to think it's helping.
Chris, I think that, you know, I think people still see nothing wrong with names like Robert E. Lee Park. Mm-hmm. People still see that the Civil War as a war between brothers that was resolved. And you look at our own state anthem, Maryland, My Maryland, by James Ryder Randall, who was a slave owner and hated Lincoln and was pro-Confederacy. Our state song.
Repel the Northern Scum, wasn't that the...
Exactly right. And
our state flag.
Our state and lauds slavery. So, I mean, that's...
That red and white is pro-secession, right. You know?
And I thank Dr. Bynum for bringing up that point. One of the things that I'm hearing in the conversation is that sort of like, what are we to make of some of the reactions that people are having? And sort of my analysis of that, just from a personal and research perspective, is that I think a lot of times in this country, we've grossly underestimated the normalcy of such oppression that has been ingrained, how ingrained this stuff is. And I think an example would be the Star Spangled Banner, Francis Scott Key. Clarence Lussain is a scholar. He wrote the text Black History of the White House. And actually, if you look into that text, you'll find that Francis Scott Key was actually around at the time, and not only did he have a role to play in sort of the initial construction and was around in that area, but also he was a part of the unjust legal system at that period. And if we transition to look at Andrew Jackson on the $20 bill, and another scholar I want to highlight is Ralph Clayton, local scholar, has the text Cash for Blood, which talks about the internal slave trade between Baltimore and New Orleans.
Right.
And why do I bring all this up? Because we don't have to look to the Confederate flag for these symbols. We just need to look to Pratt Street and look at all the slave pens that used to be on Pratt.
Lexington,
where 830 East, where, and we can look to Lexington, we can look to Caroline Street, we can look to Gay Street. I think that the conversation is so layered that we are at a point where we're talking about it, but I think that the pushback that we're seeing from something that many assume as basic as the Confederate flag tells us how, imagine the pushback when it's a little bit something stronger, when it's not just the Confederate flag, when it is one of those more comfortable symbols, one of those symbols that people are more used to. So I think we have to have the conversation about both the obscene and the mundane. That is where I think we really begin. Because as you said, this is a good point for this conversation. But if we focus only on the obscene, we miss the everyday. And that is where we want to go as well.
And I think that there's a curious kind of use value that is not I've not yet heard as part of the conversation. And that kind of ends up being very practical in kind of my movements as a Black woman in everyday life. So the Confederate flag ends up being a very easy way to know where I'm supposed to be and where I'm not supposed to be. Mm-hmm. The name of something ends up being a very easy way to let me know where I'm supposed to be and not supposed to be. And I think the reality isn't just about, oh, changing the name of something so that we can feel better about ourselves and our history, but I do think that because we haven't dismantled the system of white supremacy, what needs to be remembered is the way in which these markers of white supremacy end up being a safety tool in some kind of odd and curious way. So when I used to drive up 95 and saw the big Confederate flag in Cecil County, like, oh, that's not where I'm gonna go to get gas. that's helpful, you know. And I think that has to find its way into the conversation as well.
I know the Confederate flag you're talking about just before you hit the line in Delaware,
yeah,
and the bridge, and that flag actually is on somebody's private property.
Yeah, yeah, it's on a roof, and it's huge.
It's a huge flag that belongs to a guy who owns a construction company and flies that flag. I've always had the fantasy of buying the land across the road if I had the money and putting a big sign saying, "You lost."
indeed.
But sorry, I just had to kind of conclude that way. But this has been a fascinating conversation. First of all, I want to thank everybody for really taking part here. Yoni Applebaum, I really appreciate what you do as senior editor of politics over at The Atlantic and what you're putting out there, and having our dear friend Ta-Nehisi there is writing as well. So I want to thank you so much, and we look forward to you joining us again for a longer and straighter conversation. It's good to have you with us.
Pleasure to be with you this morning.
Very good. And Evan, always good to talk to you.
Great to talk to you too, Mark.
And at the top of the next hour, we'll be finding out what's in this week's City Paper, and also linking to Stop Honoring White Supremacy, his article in the City Paper. And Dr. Tara Bynum, always great to have you in studio and seeing you once again.
Yeah, you
but
too.
As long as we can keep you in Baltimore.
Indeed.
The next couple of months anyway, right?
Exactly.
And good to meet you, Chris Roberts, doctoral student and instructor of African American Studies, at Temple University. Great to have you here.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
We're going to take a very brief break, and on our way out, we're hearing A Winter Lady by Leonard Cohen, which was featured in the film McCabe and Mrs. Miller, released on this day in 1971. When we return from our news break here, we'll be talking to Robert King, the only free member of the Angola Three, to talk about what is happening in around that issue. If you don't know about it, you need to hear about it. We're going to talk about it in the next part of our program. He's the author also of Bottom of the Heap, the autobiography of a Black Panther, Robert Hillary King. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Used to wear her hair like you, except when she was sleeping. And then she'd weave it on a loom of smoke and gold and breathing. And why are you so quiet now?